There, the wheels are going. This is an interview on August 15th, 1987, in the Emmanuel Parish Hall with Father David L. Seeger and wife Nancy. Father Seeger is a product of significance for our centennial book.
This is David Seeger speaking.
This is Nancy Seeger speaking.
Nancy, Neshota House, Neshota, Wisconsin. Your phone number?
414-646-8909.
What do you do there, Father?
I'm the Director of Admissions and Alumni.
And what is Neshota House?
It's a seminary of the Episcopal Church. I've just joined the staff there. I was on the staff, the presiding bishop, as assistant director of church deployment in New York.
And what brings you to Neshota House?
I was invited to go. I wanted to go to Neshota House. I studied there, and the dean asked me if I'd like to come back and join the staff, and I was ready to leave New York and go.
Are you an instructor?
No, I'm the director of admissions and alumni.
No teaching responsibilities.
No.
Well, tell us about it. How big an institution is it?
We have about 100 students. That's approximately, because I'm just joining. I don't know the exact count. Average entering age now around 37. When I entered, it was around 26. I entered in 1969, and the church has changed during that time. The first year that I was there, they had the first woman ever to attend the Neshota House. Now about 15% of the student body is made up of women.
Father, you were born where and when?
I was born in Mason City, Iowa, April 28, 1938. I'm a lifelong Episcopalian.
And you went to Neshota House.
I just went to Neshota House. But if to do this linearly, I graduated from the University of Iowa in 1960.
What was your major?
Political science. And then I came out here to the Black Hills, and that's where our beginnings with Emmanuel started during the. During that summer of 1960, and we became more involved by 1961, after we were married. We weren't married in this parish. We were married in Iowa City. And I vaguely remember Mr. Pipes, not real well. But I remember his presence here. And then my more complete recollections are around Father King. And then we had a close association with his curate, Martin Rassard, who came here in the fall of 1964 and I believe was here until the fall of 1968 or maybe the spring of 1968.
How do you spell Rassard?
R-I-S-A-R-D. First name is Mark.
Boy, what brought you to the Black Hills in the first place?
Nancy.
Nancy, a Black Hills native?
No, I'm a Pierre native, but my parents always had a summer home in Hysega.
Uh-huh.
So David followed me to Hysega.
I see. And, okay, David, take it from there.
Okay. I had been teaching in the Rapid City Public Schools, and this is almost verbatim how this occurred. I came over here to this parish house one afternoon to greet the new curate. Father King at the time was deputy to the General Convention meeting in St. Louis, and so he was gone, and I was chatting with Father Rassard, and he was telling me about his various activities in his past, and he asked me if I'd ever considered any missionary activity, And I said, no, we hadn't really considered that. And he said, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about it. And
you were married by this time?
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. We were married. We had one child at the time, Nikki, N-I-K-K-I, who had been born in 1962. And Nancy may or may not have been pregnant by that time in the fall. Anyway, Shelby was born in May of 1965. Father Rosar was telling us about the South Pacific, and I told him that we had just recently seen mutiny on the Bounty, and if he could get us to Tahiti, I'd be willing to go. And he said, well, not Tahiti, because that was French and we didn't have any work there. He said, but I can get you to Fiji.
Which is just the same.
And that was sort of the way it was presented.
Was this done in a bantering manner?
This was done in a bantering manner. And but I, as I look back on it now, I really do detect the Holy Spirit working in our lives with it.
What were you teaching?
Well, I was teaching American government, and that's really, I think, is an important part of it, that I like teaching and all, but I certainly did have a certain dissatisfaction. I had thought that I wanted to go to seminary, I don't know how far back, maybe from the time I might have been about 7 years old, and I kind of got detracted. The only thing that was very mature about me when I graduated from the University of Iowa was that I knew I was too immature to go to seminary. And bided my time, so to speak, for a while. But I told, when I got home that day, I told Nancy what Father Rosard had said, and she certainly didn't say no, and we just, we weren't really very conscious of it, but we put it on the back burner. And then he had talked to us on several other occasions as months went by. It just seemed to come into conversation, and then we finally we said yes, we would go.
You had been a member of this parish at that time.
Yes, mm-hmm. We were.
But were you born and raised in this parish?
No, I was born in Pierce. Yeah. So I'm a lifelong Episcopalian also.
But had you...
I'd always attended church here when we were in, during the summer.
But by this time, you were both members of this.
Yeah, we were married and members of this parish, and I suppose our letters of transfer from our respective parishes probably came here in, sometime in 1961, I would think. That would have been when we would have ecclesiastically have become members of this parish.
What grade level were you teaching?
I was teaching juniors at Rapid City High School, and we had only the one high school then, which is Dakota Junior High now. Our activities in the parish, I served at the altar. As I recall, we didn't have many men who did it. Most of them were boys at the time. I don't believe we had any girls who served at the altar. I guess I did some lay reading. We did not have as extensive a program then as we have now. Nancy did things. She can speak for herself.
I taught Sunday school and secretary of St. Margaret's Guild and church women functions. We were pretty fairly active.
We were. Yeah. We kind of showed up about every time the bell rang, but doing various things.
You're active in the parish?
Yes.
Children and girls were baptized here. Girls were baptized here.
Yeah. All their children were baptized here, but that time...
Just the two girls.
The two girls were both baptized here. When Father Rosard started planted the seed for the missionary activity, the problem was, where does one go? How do you do it? Who pays for it? Things such as that. Father Rosard had some experience with mission work, and I believe had been a delegate to the Anglican Congress in Toronto in 1963 from the Diocese of California, and he had numerous contacts in Australia. among the Australian Board of Missions, and I believe had been, maybe he had been a missionary out there already. I know later he did mission work again in New Guinea. Out of the Anglican Congress came a document known called Mutual Responsibility and Interdependence in the Body of Christ, shortened to MRI. It was adopted by the General Convention in St. Louis in 1964, and what it amounted to as far as the American church is concerned, and this is my viewpoint of it, that it was the last great thrust of missionary activity on the part of the American church, because in the years soon to follow, during the primacy of John Hines as the presiding bishop, we became much more interested in domestic and particularly in urban problems as the result of unrest within this country. There seemed to be plenty of money for missionary activity, and we went through a process to be appointed as missionaries of the American church. And this included psychological and psychiatric testing and interviews with members of the staff, with the presiding bishop's staff for World Mission. And then as a result of that, we were approved and appointed missionaries sometime in 1965, probably around June of 1965. So we could then make the preparations to go to the South Pacific, we thought to Fiji, first going to Australia for a training period. But it's
Fiji.
Fiji is.
Fiji.
But as it turned out, we ended up going to New Guinea. Let me stop a second. You might be interested in looking at vestry minutes in the year 1964 and 65. Sometime during that year, the vestry made a commitment that it would spend around $3,000 a year in missionary activity. And they struck in an agreement with the American church that they would pay $150 a month towards our support. The vestry would pay.
Emmanuel.
This parish would make that sort of a financial commitment. That money was sent to New York and then sent to New Guinea.
What did it cost to keep a missionary in the field at that time?
Well, I have no idea. That probably it wasn't costing that much, I would not think.
Did you get any salary?
We were paid...
was it $12 a week?
Yeah, $12. $12 a week, I think. And maybe the children each got six. So we had 24. We had $36 a week for sort of spending money.
Groceries.
And... And well, we bought some groceries out
but
of that. Other
we
things the mission
a lot
supplied.
Of
we yeah. traded. We trade to stick tobacco and
salt.
With people who would come along, the indigenous people for their vegetables or mostly vegetables,
mm-hmm.
occasionally crabs.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't buy any flying foxes or things like that from the rats, snakes. That
no.
they would have to trade.
We had our own chickens.
Yeah, we had our own chickens while we were there. Let me sort of get this back on course. We went in January of 1966 to Australia, and we were trained by the Australian Board of Missions, the ABM, until November of 1966, when we were assigned to St. Christopher's School in Popondetta, Popondetta. Popondetta.
New Guinea.
In New Guinea, in the Diocese of New Guinea. I was a teacher there. I taught English as a foreign language, social studies, art, health. That was about it. The boys came from all over the archipelago. They were required by the government to speak English, so it was not a problem speaking in English. It's just that they did not understand it real well, and they certainly did not write it very well. I taught what we...
Excuse me, was there any attempt to suppress the native language?
No, not really at all.
There are probably around 700 different, about 500 different languages in New Guinea and about 700 different dialects. So to communicate between each other, they used a form of Pidgin English, which was acceptable and acceptable to everyone.
Or English. Those
or
who spoke English, spoke English. And indeed now, English is the official language of the country of Papua New Guinea.
There are about 200 boys in the school.
Now, I would think there, there probably were about 200 boys in the school in what we would call
training.
We would call grades 7, 8, and 9, but they probably were at least at a reading level, maybe grades 2, 3, and 4. It was a training school for vocations. They spent a lot of time. The boys spent a lot of time learning automobile mechanics. Sheet metal working.
Yeah, that many automobiles in the archipelago?
Well, it was an emerging nation, and we worked with American jeeps from World War II, and the idea that the church had was to prepare these young men to go from a subsistence economy to be able to be productive in the 20th century as towns started to develop. The brightest boys in the diocese went to Martyr School, which was our sister school, brother school, I should say, nearby. And this determination was made pretty early, which boys had the greatest potential for academic work and those that should be trained for what we would call blue-collar workers. And our mission was to train the boys who would be blue-collar workers. There were plenty of jobs in the towns. And that's what we are trying to prepare them to be able to do, to get out of the village and to be able to go to the towns where they could make some money.
Well, is this part of Polynesia?
No, this is not part of Polynesia. The New Guinea people are rather Negroid, although they say they are brown-skinned rather than black-skinned. But they have all the Negroid features. And probably only a skilled anthropologist would be able to say that they were not Negroid.
What's the language relate to? All by itself? Or
It really is. It has no relationship to the Malay languages. It has no relationship to the Polynesian languages. Mm-hmm. Further to the east, there are several theories as to how they even got there. One is that they moved eastward from Africa and ended up on this very large island. New Guinea, most people don't even know where New Guinea is. It's a large island north of Australia, the second largest island in the world, Greenland being the first.
Looks like a guinea hen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does, come to think of it.
How did it get its name?
Well, I think it probably reminded people of Guinea in West Africa, and so that's the name New Guinea. A lot of Americans, a lot of people from Rapid City know that area well from having fought there during World War II, and I'm forever running into people that say, oh, yes, they know New Guinea.
You mentioned this, when they found out you had children, they didn't want you.
Well, that was Fiji.
That was in Fiji. The bishop in Polynesia simply didn't have accommodations for a lay missionary and his family.
This is before you went to
seminary.
This
is before we went to New Guinea. We were in Australia and planning at all times to go to Fiji after Australia.
Oh, and then you got diverted to New Guinea because of the family.
Yes. The bishop in New Guinea could use a layman and his family as missionaries, whereas the bishop in Polynesia could not.
Backing up a bit, give me a brief overview of your training in Australia.
Yes. We did courses in tropical medicine, anthropology, linguistics, scripture, church history.
Mm-hmm. Carpentry, sewing, kind of survival, how to work a primus stove, that type of thing.
Well, we could survive if we needed to.
Live in the jungle.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here you are, you're teaching 200 boys.
Yes.
Yes, and I was the school nurse.
You have a medical background?
Well, I had some at the University of Iowa. I was in nursing at the University of Iowa. So.
How far did you go with that?
I went 3 years before I changed my major, but that was sufficient in the jungles of New Guinea to do almost everything but open heart surgery.
Brain transplant?
Yes, yes.
The New Guinea people...
Do you ever practice? Were you an RN?
No.
Oh, you never practiced?
No.
The New Guinea people have a great sense of spirituality. We marveled at them when we would see them in church. Their devotion was quite remarkable. Some people have been critical of the missionary effort in that we were destroying a culture, and to a certain extent that is correct.
The mere fact of us being there.
Of our presence. The missionaries were for the most part English and Australian, and they did take their culture along with them. But I think if you consider what the New Guinea people had before, there are certain trade-offs. One, we did bring them health care, whereas before a simple cut below the knee would mean an amputation or eventually death, as gangrene would set in because they didn't know how to cover up their sores and all, and that was a horrible thing.
Also malaria.
Yes.
Tuberculosis, leprosy.
Secondly, we brought them education. Some might question whether or not that is worth anything, but I think in the message of the gospel, what we relieved them most of was fear, because their religion prior to Christianity was a very primitive animism and fear of evil spirits. And there was a great deal of witchcraft. The witch doctor in the local village would have great authority and power, and the gospel relieved them of that.
In respect to witch doctor, was not too friendly with you, was he?
Well, where we were, we did not have much to do with those sorts of persons. We were not in, as New Guinea goes, we were in a very settled area. The town of Papandetta was a government and military center with a smattering of plantation owners and Chinese traders.
Population
maybe 600
something
in that vicinity, and in Greater Papandetta that would have been what the people that actually lived in the town. We may have had 200-300, I suppose. Mm-hmm. The church over the years had also acquired great power over the people's lives, in that they, I think it was the people respected the power of the church. I do recall once when the Bishop of Korea was visiting, he was having dinner with the missionaries, and all of whom were laypersons at this particular dinner. And the Bishop of Korea commented that the church was so wonderful in New Guinea, he said, "My, it's like a medieval theocracy." And we all said, "Well, that's part of the problem, because the bishop held great power, and then underneath him the archdeacons and the assistant bishops and the archdeacons and the clergy." One of the most effective things I think that was done in the missionary strategy in New Guinea was to train an indigenous clergy. And the church in New Guinea today is, it may not be self-sufficient as far as funds are concerned, but it certainly is self-sufficient as far as indigenous clergy are concerned. The archbishop is a New Guinea man. He's visited Rapid City. He came during the time when we were out in New Guinea to visit people here. The church is well respected in that part of the world.
Is New Guinea its own diocese?
Yes, it's now divided. When we were there, it was one diocese, and now it's divided into, I believe, four dioceses, presided over by a primate, Archbishop George Amble, and then the assistant bishops, AMBO.
Who is our neighbor in the Papandetta?
Yes.
So, we were there how long?
We were there for 3 years. Well, in New Guinea, we actually 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. We were gone from Rapid City for 3 years. We left in early 1966 and came back in late 1968.
And you had kept in touch with the congregation during that?
Throughout the time, we probably had weekly correspondence, that by letters, tapes, slides, that to maintain the interest in the work that we were doing. We heard from parishioners frequently, and when we came back, I guess I probably went for about a month of Sundays in speaking in this room where we're sitting, talking about what we had done there. And I did that in a chronological sort of way, and I guess it was interesting enough. They folk kept coming back. But I ran the slides again and could comment maybe a bit more than I had done on the tapes, and I answered questions and responded in that sort of way. And there was interest throughout the community as well. I spoke to several civic groups and to school children about our time in New Guinea.
At the outset, did you have to commit yourself to any time period?
To a three-year commitment. We made a three-year commitment, and when we were leaving New Guinea, the Bishop of New Guinea tried to make us, we thought, feel guilty in that. He said, well, you're deserting us. And we said, well, Bishop, we agreed to come for 3 years, and our children are getting a bit older, and we really need to go home and tend to them. And I had also...
Your children are not with you?
Oh,
they
yes.
were with us. But as they got older, we just felt that they needed to be out of that jungle environment. I'll back up for a second and say something about the children. When we went out, our girls were 3 years and 8 months. When we came back, they were 6 and 3. Our youngest, Shelby, when we was really a child of the jungle. When we got off the plane in Hong Kong on our way home, that was the first time she had ever stood on concrete. That evening was the first time she had ever seen neon, the first time she had ever had a flush toilet, the first time that she had ever been in a place where water ran endlessly. We had had a bucket shower in New Guinea, and we had to ration the water when we would take our showers. I believe it was the first time Shelby had worn shoes to any extent and really did not like to wear shoes, nor did she like to wear much clothing at all. But she learned. She wasn't real fond of white people because they all had to hold her and embrace her when we got home, whereas her friends in New Guinea just sort of let her be. So there was a bit of culture shock for Shelby. Nikki did not have quite as much. She had started school in New Guinea, and we believe got a very good foundation at the local government school.
Nikki, at 3, started school.
But she started in Australia in a preschool, but she started kindergarten at 4 in New Guinea. And she learned to read that year. They pushed them quite a bit. Nikki's
the oldest
one.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
It's 3 years. Did that include your almost a year in Australia?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. About 10 months in Australia.
10 months in Australia.
A little over 2 years, actually, on
mm-hmm.
the stage.
Right.
And then Bishop tried to load you with a guilt trip.
He wanted us to stay longer.
Which
right.
was flattering, but
he had a need for missionaries. But it's very interesting in that I think within 2 years after we had left New Guinea, they had achieved independence, and the and the missionaries were being phased out, it appeared that the church was doing the missionaries a favor in letting them stay. There were some English persons who had spent almost their entire adult lives in New Guinea and really did not want to return to England. They were no longer that necessary to the ongoing mission of the church in New Guinea, but of course were allowed to stay and make some contribution to that effort. But the church had matured to the point where it could take care of itself.
Say, New Guinea achieved independence from whom?
Well, I guess from Australia. It was an interesting mix of governments in Australia or in New Guinea. The territory of New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, was divided into two sections. Papua was under the control of the Australians. New Guinea was a trust of the United Nations, but it was administered by Australia as if the entire archipelago was Australia's own possession. New Guinea had passed to the League of Nations after World War I, when the German territories were taken away from Germany, and then to the United Nations after World War II, and Australia administered the territory.
Were you in any kind of a competitive situation with the Catholics or the Presbyterians or the Mormons?
No, to a certain degree, but not much. The territory of New Guinea had been divided up by the government among the various denominations, similar to the Grand Peace Settlement in South Dakota, and so that they would prevent proselytizing and competition among the various denominations. And this was honored. There was a section of New Guinea that was given to the Lutherans, another section to the Roman Catholics, and the third section to the Anglicans. That worked well until the people became, one, more mobile, and two, when the smaller denominations came in and wanted to participate as well. In our area, we did have some Jehovah's Witnesses who were trying to make their way in, and it was handled. Maybe it wasn't the Americans might not like the way it was handled, but the Bishop of New Guinea simply excommunicated those people who went to the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yes.
Well, the Anglican bishops. It's the Church of England in Australia, and as I said earlier, he held great power.
So you were Anglicans while you were there.
Yeah. Well,
same. We're Anglicans now.
We're Anglicans this moment, as we speak.
It's all very similar,
yes.
Of course.
So you returned to Rapid City?
Came back to Rapid City in November of 1968, or early December 1968, yes. And I went back to the Rapid City Public Schools for the second semester, and I taught the second semester, and at that time started the process to enter seminary. We had an interesting situation in the diocese at the time in that Conrad Gessner was preparing to retire as bishop. Lyman Ogilvie had been appointed his successor because we were not allowed to elect our own bishop then because the missionary dioceses were not permitted that. But during that time...
Excuse me, going back to New Guinea, was that a missionary diocese?
Yes,
a
missionary.
You were there.
Yes, but not part of the American church. It was part of the English church, or the Australian church.
Right.
And then during that same year, we were allowed to elect their own bishop, which we did, and we elected Walter Jones as the first elected bishop of this diocese. And so during the one calendar year, I served under three bishops within this diocese.
That would be, review that again.
Yes. When we came home, Conrad Gessner was the diocesan. Lyman Ogilvie had left the Philippines, where he had been bishop, and was appointed to succeed Conrad Gessner as Bishop of South Dakota. Once the diocese was allowed to elect their own bishop, Ogilvie resigned, and Walter Jones was elected.
Did Ogilvie actually serve?
Oh, yes.
Yes, he did. He served a very short time, less than a year.
Mm-hmm. How do you spell that?
Ogilvy. First name Lyman, L-Y-M-A-N. And then he subsequently became Bishop of Pennsylvania.
Okay, so you served, you taught the second semester in the Machine Public School while you were... I take it the decision to return to the States entailed no great soul-searching or traumatic inner conflict. You decided it was time to go.
No. Living in the jungle is not easy. I was ready for running water and electric lights.
You were
lights
right
and,
on the equator, aren't you?
And, yes.
The equator go right through the Guinea?
No, we're a little south.
Yeah, we were 6 degrees south in Papendetta of the equator. I did not feel any great demand that we stay in New Guinea. There is certainly nothing apparent in our lives. We love the people, but it was time to leave.
You didn't want your daughter to be a jungle girl.
Well, that's true.
Also, I was very anxious to go to seminary. I felt a strong call to that. And when we came home, I wasn't exactly certain how that was going to work, but I did begin the process and had I made the applications, the canonical applications, and had psychiatric testing and all that sort of thing. One concern that we did have was how were we going to pay for this whole thing. During the spring of 1969, two things happened that certainly made this possible. One, the vestry voted to continue the $150 a month payments throughout the time we were in seminary, and you'll find that also in the minutes of the vestry. Secondly, and I believe it's a parishioner. Anyway, there was an anonymous gift that I've always assumed has come from a parishioner to pay my tuition for each of the 3 years that we were in seminary.
You went to Neshota.
I went to Neshota House, and
where is that from Milwaukee?
It's equidistant between Milwaukee and Madison, just off Interstate 94. While I was at Neshota House, I worked, and I also had some scholarship money so that we were able to get along.
What did you work at?
I was the mailman. Every student at Neshota House works. That's one of the demands, I guess you could say, requirements that we make of every student, that they all work. The things that are not negotiable are, one, the students have to be in chapel 2 times a day. They go for morning prayer and the Eucharist in the morning and return again for evensong in the evening. Secondly, they have to work, and thirdly, they have to go to class and study. Some people think that we're a little outmoded, but we're very proud of that, and I'm glad I went to Neshota House. It formed me and has helped my priesthood, I think, a great deal. Having had the financial concerns put to rest, there's a personal thing within our family that occurred during that spring. Had we not gone to New Guinea, we probably would have had another child. I hope we would have had another child, but we did not think it was a good thing to do while we were in those primitive conditions. So when we came home, we decided we would like to adopt a child. We had contacted Lutheran Social Services about this, and what...
Karen Robinson.
And when we were asked what would we like... we felt a little bit guilty. We said, well, we'll just take a baby. And they said, well, no, you know, you can say what you would like. Well, we said we would like to have a boy, and we would like him to be well and predictably educable. So those were the requirements that we had. And then the whole that process started, and we were waiting and waiting, and they... One day they called and said the Kurt Paulson, who I believe is still in Rapid City, was working with us and said that he thought that they had a Cree Indian boy from Canada. And And then later that didn't work. And the reason was Kurt said that he did not respond to love. I don't know what had happened to this child. Had he been so abused or what? But anyway, that was not to be our child. So we went off to seminary with just the two girls in September of 1969. And in early December of 1969, Kurt called and said that he had our son, and he was in Denver. And his mother was Mexican, and his father was a Swedish exchange student. And so I was taking my final exams, and my father had had a heart attack, and Nancy went off to Denver to pick up our little boy. And when she found him, he had blonde hair and blue eyes. The father's genes had evidently dominated. His name is Adam, and he was baptized in this parish on the first Sunday after Christmas in 1969.
At what age?
We got him when he was 6 months old.
5 months old. Yeah.
Five months old. He was born on July 17th, and Nancy picked him up on December 17th. So he was 5 months old when we got him. And he returned in the Shota house after Christmas with us in the first January of 1970. During the summers when I was at the Shota house during the three-year course that I was there, the first summer I did clinical pastoral education, also known as CPE. The seminarians don't like it, but it's a good time for us to examine our call and develop some pastoral skills in a clinical situation. I did my time at the North Dakota State Hospital, a mental hospital in Jamestown, and my family remained here. The second summer of seminary, Bishop Walter invited me to be the manager of the camp west of Lead, and I did that for two summers, the summer between my middler and senior year and the summer after I graduated.
Camp west of Lead.
Thunderhead.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think of it as west of Lead. Okay.
Isn't it west of Lead?
Yeah, it is.
That's one way to get there.
Okay. My course in seminary was the normal course of preparing priests in this church. I studied theology, scripture, church history, liturgics, spirituality, Greek. And I graduated in May of 1972. And
okay.
Go ahead.
Congratulations.
I have never understood why, but I'm glad it occurred. An agreement was struck between the dean and faculty of Neshota House and the Bishop of South Dakota, Walter Jones, that I could be ordained at the end of my middler year. That is my second year. That is a most unusual thing. Sometimes seminarians are ordained about midway through their senior year. So I was ordained probably a full semester early. So in June of 1971, I took my canonical exams in, of all places, Chamberlain, South Dakota. And I thought about the scholars who had studied in Rome, Constantinople, and places like that.
There you were.
I was being examined in Chamberlain. I passed my canonical exams, and I was ordained deacon in this parish on the feast of St. Jean Vianney, August 8th, 1971.
You know, for the benefit of the transcriber, we have to spell that.
Yes. Jean, J-E-A-N, Vianney, V-I-A-N-N-E-Y. It was a Sunday. And
V as in Victor.
V as in Victor. And Bishop Jones ordained me. Father King was my clerical presenter. Grace and Chuck Bennett were the lay presenters at the ordination. The choir sang. It was wonderful. It was a glorious liturgical event. And so I went off to back to Neshota House to start my senior year ordained as a deacon.